Yo soy Yolanda Santiago Correa.
Yo soy Nora de Arco.
Yo soy Esperanza Jean.
Yo soy Andrés de Arco.
Soy Gessner Josué Pereira Sánchez Otálora Rentería.
Y bienvenidos a Majestad Prieta.
Hola a todos, bienvenidos a otro episodio de Majestad Prieta, el episodio número 3. Feliz marzo, estamos felices de que estén con nosotros por tercera vez en el episodio. Y si esta es tu primera vez, bienvenido, bienvenida, bienvenide. Puedes ver todo nuestro otro contenido en Spotify o Apple Podcasts o cualquiera de las plataformas en la que escuchas tus podcasts. Y estamos en el mes de marzo, como dije, y en este mes celebramos o conmemoramos, mejor dicho, el Día Internacional de la Mujer Trabajadora y el Mes de la Mujer. Y por esa razón, ese es el tema que queremos tocar en el día de hoy. Es obvio y seguro has visto durante todo este mes muchas manifestaciones, muchas conversaciones, mucho contenido creado alrededor de la imagen de la mujer o el rol de la mujer en la sociedad, lo mucho que la mujer ha logrado o progresado, todas estas ideas. Pues, y por eso mismo nosotros queríamos tomar un episodio, un momento para discutir qué es esto, qué, cuál es el significado, por qué es necesario hablar del rol de la mujer y especialmente para el propósito de este podcast, why is it important for us to talk about womanhood and what it means to be a woman, specifically what it means for that to intersect with the identity as Black women. ¿Qué tiene que ver la raza con esta idea de la femininidad o la mujer o todo esto y cómo esto se manifiesta en la comunidad latina? And so we want to take the opportunity to just have an honest, open conversation about that. So we hope that you join us and then you give us your ideas as well and tell us of your experience. And with that, we want to start the conversation. So what's the significance? Why is it important? Why is a theme like this something that we need to talk about?
Bueno, I think like in our communities, we have important markers, right, of womanhood, like una quinceañera, right? So like it is already embedded into, I think, the culture, this marker of she's gone from a girl to a woman, right? And mostly that's signifying the fact that we are ready in some ways, right? Like I'm saying that in quotes, to go into womanhood and more specifically go into motherhood. So I feel like you can't really talk about Latinidad without really also addressing some of these very clear gender expectations that are in our communities for us as women. Pero I think on a more personal note, I don't even like what is actual womanhood? Like what does that even mean? I don't even think that I've really thought about that. Like what is womanhood? And maybe you all can chime in and share your thoughts, but I don't think that I've really sat down and really thought about it. I think for me, it's just kind of been life, you know?
I think there's two things that are interesting with what you say, Nora, with the whole idea of definition, especially because you say that there's no definition and that you mention one very particular thing or two that I think very much act as definers. Porque yo creo que lo que pasa con el fenómeno este de of women en la comunidad Latinx is that there's certain roles, like you said, certain things that need to be met. Y yo creo que la quinceañera, so that moment when you turn 15, when you supposedly become a woman, and then the idea of motherhood and the responsibility of a woman to be a mother and that being the main role, I think is something that in a sense, acts as a definer, even though it shouldn't be. And so I think it's interesting that you bring that up, and that that becomes sort of part of the unconscious way that we talk about women in the Latino community. And what I hear, Esperanza, is that there's sort of like not a definition, but at the same time, a very solid definition, very solid structural definition for mm-hmm. our communities of what it means to be a woman. So you are a person who is limited by who you are. And so you get certain things like you mentioned what you earn. So like your place in the workplace, how far you can go, what you can enact as a member of the workspace. And that mm-hmm. also translates into then motherhood. So like becoming a woman, like there's a part of it that is intrinsically psychologically tied to the idea of tienes que convertirte en mamá para ser mujer. And then also the emotional labor and the issue of safety and worth, where there's sort of this, I think it's interesting because to me, there's sort of this championing of the woman como una mamá. So like, I think especialmente en la comunidad Latinx, hay como un énfasis gigantesco in this idea of the mom, and like my mom is everything, my mom makes the house, you know, my mom is the one that can cook the best, like all of these ideas. So there's sort of on the one side this idea of the woman, and the woman as the one that makes the home and is the head of the home, but at the same time it's a power or an authority that is relegated to a certain position, to where you get power in terms of being a mom and forming children, but you don't get power in terms of becoming a member of the workplace or being the highest earning person of the house or other things. And so I think it's very interesting how those things get constructed into an idea of what a woman is or needs to be, and how women who challenge those automatically get questioned or get thrown with, like get words thrown at them, like intimidating or loud or all of the other things, which to go further in the conversation is a stereotype that is tied to Latina women specifically. And then I think this is where the issue of race or the ideas around race also tie in, because there's a very very obvious line of division between how a white woman will get perceived versus a Black woman, regardless of whether they hold Latina as part of their identity or not.
1,000%. You just said so many things that have my brain firing off in a million different directions que yo ni sé cuál cosa primero. Pero man, one quick thing. And Nora, ya yo veo que la misma cosa está pasando con ti también. I can't wait to hear what you're about to say. So I'll just say this one quick thing about what you mentioned when it comes to motherhood, especialmente en nuestro, tú sabes, comunidad Latinx. I would go as far to say as I don't even believe it's socially honest to say that women are given power, the mothers, to shape and mold and lead the household in within that particular modality. I would say it is a bait and switch of a false sense of power.
Of authority. Dang.
Of authority. Okay. It's a false sense of authority, because what it really is an obligation.
Yeah.
It is a responsibility, because men get to decide what is and isn't okay when it comes to the role of mother, which also bleeds over for a lot of people into the role of wife. Y yo sé claro que cada madre no está, you know, casado, you know, so it's not always tied together, but for some people it is, you know. Si los hombres en la familia deciden que la manera en que tú estás tratando a los niños no es correcto, o que algo tiene que cambiar, or that like, oh, why are you, anything that challenges patriarchal norms. If a mother is mothering in a way
that aligns with how men as the, I'm saying the political collective has decided, no, this is what is and isn't okay for the kids. The boys throw balls, the girls paint their nails, any other thing that you can think of that falls in those kind of binaries and categories. Oh, then everything's fine. De esa manera el papá puede estar ahí, tú sabes, chilling, not really engaged, emotionally uninvolved, you know, trabajando, claro, pero suficiente si está trabajando, that's enough, and se acabó. But if any of those norms are being challenged, and if those standards of what mothering is supposed to look like within the patriarchal system is not being met, olvídate. Then if we think of it kind of like how, like with card games or whatever, you know, the man in the house always holds the joker, always holds the trump card. And I hate that that word is ruined now, but always, I hate that. Always holds that veto. There we go. Always holds that veto of like, yeah. I was letting her do what she thought best, but now my son is getting soft and I don't like this because I think she's, you know, doing, I don't like how she's mothering this way, or the food wasn't ready, or the kid, you know, whatever standard it is, the man is still ultimately the authoritarian that is holding the woman to the standard of you must fulfill these obligations, because if you don't, then what are you doing? This is not okay, you know?
And you mentioned, I think it's interesting, and I want to hear what Nora has to say, but I think it's interesting that you also mentioned this idea of the man holds the joker, porque tienes razón, y especialmente when we think about the idea that you said about mothers who don't have partners, particularly when it's mother and father, so man and woman, and we'll talk about the issues with the binary and things like that further down. But it's interesting because when we get this image of la madre soltera, there's always this idea of the mom is the la mamá y el papá, and so certain like quote unquote masculine characteristics, aesthetics, ideas, terms will get assigned to the mother in order to make the mother seen as a capable person that can carry la crianza de los niños by herself. And so I think you made me think about how that gets used, and how then things that we associate or like politically, socially have been associated with man or masculine get like put onto womanhood, whatever, in order to make woman then, capable or able to fulfill this role.
I think this conversation has been so interesting because these things tie back to the point that you were talking about earlier, Esperanza, where it's also tied to worth, right? Like the worth of a woman is in how well she can raise her family, how well she can take care of her household, and all of these things. Like it's, you know, if you can't really cook, it's like, well, you know, are you really a good mom? If you can't really do certain, you know, certain household, if you don't like to clean, if maybe your house is a bit messier than other homes, then, oh, you're not a good mom. You know, if your kids look a certain way. But it's interesting to go back to the point that you had said earlier about this obligation versus choice. And I think that a lot of times when looking at dynamics within the family, especially Latinx communities, there's a lot of roles and obligations that the girl or the oldest sister has to perform, which mimic roles of a mother, right? So she might have to become a second mother. And, you know, whether she has the bandwidth to do that, whether she has the emotional stability to do so, she is supposed to take on that role, right? That it's an obligation. And it might not be for her male siblings, right? So I think these things are really interesting because since they are tied to worth, I think emotionally too for women, it also forms this load, right? This load that we are carrying because we have a lot of expectations that are tied to our worth. So if we're not meeting these expectations, then internally we are also facing like, well, I'm not woman enough, right? Or I'm not doing things correctly. Well, also I think being very burdened with a lot of other people's emotional baggage that we have to sort for them, or just feeling the pressure of just having so many obligations on our shoulders. So,
you know, that reminds me a lot of this poem by Stacey Ann Chance. She's a Jamaican poet. And she writes this poem called The Endangered Black Woman. And she talks about that, exactly what y'all are talking about, that there's a lot of things placed upon the backs of the bodies of Black women all throughout history. And so that oftentimes they do have to care for a lot of other people before they care for themselves. And in that poem, she says that she's like, well, when is the time to take care of my needs and my things? And why do I have to worry about everything that happens in the world? And I do think that has been a burden, right? And it may not only be motherhood specifically. When you think of Jamaica, she's talking about a specific context within Jamaica and the Jamaican diaspora. And there's a very specific context there of like being babysitters and caretaking and stuff that she's referring to. But she's also referring to the fact that Black women on the ranking of that, like she makes a list like, when everyone, why do I have to care about how Black men do, how white men feel, how white women feel, how all these things feel? And I do think that when we talk specifically about Black womanhood, and if we get specific to Afro-Latina womanhood, right? Afro-Latinas themselves, Afro-Latinas, in my opinion, in my experience within the Afro-Latino activist world, Afro-Latina activist world, it's really women who lead most of the movement. It's really women who have led most of the charge, right? It's Dr. Marta Moreno Vega, who was really early. It's Miriam Jimenez Roman, who was really early. Like, most of the people that is Yvette Modestine, who's another one, is really early. Like, most of the people that we mention are women. And so, and there is this additional burden. But I do think that then, that in my opinion, right, as a cisgender male, as an Afro-Latino, but in my opinion, I do see that is to the benefit of our movement and has pushed us to be much more inclusive. I do think that when we get a Black woman perspective, when we get a perspective from an Afro-Latina, when we get that, then there is a something that we get that the movements get that we wouldn't get if it was led by a male, by a man, because there's a more myopic view as a man of what's important, where I feel that it could be more inclusive. So I don't know how that fits into this, but I was just thinking of the poem because I do think that like there is a lot of burden, right? There's also Black women have also been taken advantage of historically, right? More so than any other women, especially in our context throughout the Americas. It was always the Black woman who had a lot more burden and responsibility and things to carry, and I have to mother my children from a legitimate marriage, and then children that may not be mine, and then all these other things. And I do feel that is I'd like to go back to the point that I think that's something that we have to worry about. But I do think that I feel like, especially within the Afro-Latina movement, I feel like that movement is led by women. Like I just feel, and I often feel like that's really a strength of the movement, that is very inclusive from the jump. But that's just my opinion.
And I think, Josue, that what that brings, I think goes back to what I mentioned before, there's something to say about how race interacts with somebody's identity as a woman that I think you're getting at from the positive side, but that also carries a very negative side to it that has to do with all of these obligations that have been mentioned before in this experience. But I think that there's particularities that come with being a non-white woman that get expressed, and for the particularities of the Latina community, whether one identifies as an Afro-Latina or is just visibly not white, so brown if we want to use that term or whatever, if you are visibly other in terms of ethnicity than non-white, there are certain other weights and stereotypes and obligations that get put onto you. And there are also certain preoccupations that you need to have operating in the world. And I think this reminds me of what Esperanza was saying about safety and Nora was saying about worth, specifically because my experience coming to the US is that there's a very specific stereotype around like the fiery Latina woman. And for men in the United States specifically, there's sort of a, how can I say this? There's sort of like a trophy to be won or like a medal to be gained for your history of life to say that you will have dated a Latina woman or have engaged with one, a fetish. Yes, thank you, Esperanza. There's this fetish or this like sexualization. There's almost this fantasy to where people, specifically men, will speak about this whole thing and will say like, ah, las Latinas son unas locas y te van a cortar la goma, but like that's where you want to be. And so there's all of these stereotypes that I think operate with all of the other things that you were saying about expectations in a movement too and being a leader. And I think tie also to ideas of how one gets to exist in the world. And I know that my experience is that there's always that fear, because at least for my own identity como una puertorriqueña, there's a huge thing with like Puerto Rican women and the whole idea of like la mujer puertorriqueña with images like J-Lo and things like that. And usually, when interacting with men, they're like, ah, tú eres puertorriqueña, yo tuve una novia puertorriqueña que estaba bien loca, tú debes ser loca también. And there's this, like, these whole constructions around the relationship between race and the identity of woman that I think take this topic a little bit further, and that I think is what womanist theologians in the African-American community and other theologians or thinkers even in the Black feminist movement have critiqued of white feminism too, where like these things get added and we don't talk about them either. So there's sort of this positive to the perspective of a Black woman or of an Afro-Latina woman, but then there's also all of these negatives that get added that are very particular to the experience of being both a woman and Black.
Yeah, and I want to jump in and go back to Josue's point on movement specifically. And I think a lot of times we kind of overlook how essential Black women have been not only to movements, but to revolutions. And especially, like, we can go even way back to like the transatlantic slave trade, where there's a direct correlation and a higher likelihood that the overseers would be overthrown when there are more women on the ships. And so there's different, like, this is not just like in recent sort of history or the way that we're looking at it in a contemporary view, but this has been the case for a while. And I think when I think about womanhood, I think the first image that comes to my mind is my mom. And like a lot of what Yolanda's saying is resonating with me, because I just remember so many occasions where my mom was classified as intimidating, like as an intimidating woman, and she's someone to like be very direct and frank with people. But I was like, I wouldn't necessarily see her as like an intimidating figure, I mean, because she was my mom. But it's interesting to see that you start seeing where the lines are of expectations once you start a lot of times seeing the reaction from men and to how they react to just their existence or just them speaking. And so I think there is a strong sort of correlation there. And I think policing is something that's constantly existing within this paradigm, where we're constantly having to police ourselves within patriarchal systems. And I think especially for women, they feel the brunt of it because it's not designed for women necessarily to speak up, to exist in a way that defies a man's sort of way of life.
And that's, and just to agree quickly, Andres, I think that's a really good point. I think that's also because oftentimes, and I think it's until like really womanist, feminist, and mujerista, people started to like really frame that the conversation sometimes of women is framed around men. And I think that's a problem, right? Like it doesn't need to be framed around men or masculinity. It needs to be not framed around that. And and that's why it leads to what you were talking about, Yolanda, is what Stacey Ann Chin in that poem that I mentioned, Endangered Black Woman, she calls fetishized hatred. She's like, there's like a, it's like a weird hatred that we get from men, but also like this fetish, like that we want to be, you know, quote unquote, you know, be part or be together with that guy, but there's this like fetishized hatred that becomes a part. And I do think that that's part of the frame. I think when we start to frame discussions of women, not around men, but really frame it around women, then I think that changes some of the paradigm, right? Because if we just say, well, you know, like what are those phrases that you hear, like behind a successful Black man is a strong Black woman or whatever, all these different phrases. Yes, but that's a roll her eyes because you've heard them, like you hear those phrases, like then it's like, why is that the frame? Actually, the frame should really be that technically that a really strong Black woman really, engenders strong children of whatever gender. And so, and I think that framing also changes a bit. I don't know how that fits into this, but I do think that is what I think sometimes happens with these discussions, that with discussions around Black womanhood, that it's often that then it gets framed. The frame then becomes the male. Oh, so how does the woman fit in this frame of the male and not the other way around, or not even just saying that there shouldn't be necessarily these frames. So I don't know, that's what came to mind once you said that, Andres, about the framing.
I think just to piggyback on that point and to what Andres said, so for anyone listening who doesn't know, Andres and I are actually related. We are siblings, and growing up, I think our mother is an attorney by practice, growing up with a mother who is very strong and, you know, opinionated. In a way, there was a lot of policing and a lot of reframing of her character, right? So instead of being, especially when, you know, you're used to somebody who can, I mean, if they can do it in a courtroom, it's no issue for them to be like, fact check, that doesn't make sense. And then, you know, essentially, you know, to ask you questions, right? And I think that women who have questions are dangerous women in a very good way, because we are getting to truth, right? But we are also perceived as dangerous. It's too much. We are, you know, I think a label that has gotten placed on my mother a lot is angry, right? You are angry. And it's not to say that she actually is. It is because I think oftentimes, you know, there's certain expectations of especially Black women that, you know, we can't question too much. That's too many questions. You're weird for asking too many questions. You too smart for your own good for asking too many questions. And then when we disagree, vocally disagree with something, which is also a right of every human being, you know, you can voice your opinion. It doesn't have to agree with others. This, oh, you're angry. You know, you're just so it, our thoughts and opinions, I think, then become invalidated because another person, usually a man, has said that they are not valid in itself and has just use the label of angry or too much to kind of just negate the facts, honestly. And a lot of the times there are facts that are just completely, you know, thrown over because somebody feels some type of way. This woman is too much. She's too much of a woman, right? So I think that also, I think for me, growing up, there's been a lot of times where I kind of just shrunk myself because I didn't want to be too much, right? I didn't want to be labeled as this woman who is maybe too opinionated, or I stopped asking too many questions, you know? So there's also these parts that these tactics of, like Andres was saying, of policing to enforce and kind of remind us where our place is. Or one of the things that really, really bothers me is, you know, when our feelings, you can be stating something like, oh, are you sure about that? Like, are you sure that you would know? Yes, I would know how I feel. I am the expert on myself, right? So these questionings of self that happen, especially to women, I think that can lead us into spaces where we really do shrink ourselves to not, because we've been, I think it kind of is reinforced, right, that there are certain places and we can only be woman to a certain degree. And if it becomes too much, then we need to be reminded of where we should be.
Yeah, that choice to shrink and be smaller is such a very real thing in terms of, I see it as one of the options at a crossroads, really. Porque cuando la gente viene con su cosa, and I say gente intentionally because internalized patriarchy is a thing. And so the issues are not only with the way men are socialized, but it's also with the issues with the way women are socialized, and not all women are walking around presently conscious to this structure of oppression and working against that. Así que cuando la gente viene con su cosa, dice que like you need to go back in line, you know, how we respond to that. And this is something I wish I would have known when I was younger. I wish I would have known how we respond to that directly impacts the trajectory of our lives as women. Because for me, as someone who grew up very oblivious to patriarchal limitations, because my father, who él tiene su propio problema. This is not a PSA of I had the perfectly feminist father, porque eso no fue lo que ocurrió. But I did have a father who, to some degree, he was aware. And to the degree that he was aware, he was like, this is stupid. I have two children. One happens to be a son. One happens to be a daughter. You both have brains. He's an educator. Both of my parents are educators, high school teachers. And so he's like, I'm going to develop both of these brains, period. You know, like that was something he got right. And so to a large degree, because of that, and I'm sure plenty of other factors, I grew up a bit oblivious to those limitations. And so I, on the one hand, the good side of that is eso me dio un poquito de espacio to come into myself without doing that particular type of shrinking. There's other shrinking that happen, but that particular type of shrinking. And so when I say I wish I would have known the weight of the decisions I was making, because it caught up to me later in life. And when I say caught up to me, I mean the consequences of patriarchy. I mean the actual like palatable hatred and fury and anger at how dare you be so outspoken? How dare you be so articulate? How dare you be so smart? How dare you be so loud? You know, how dare you be so confident? Oh, dear God, a Black woman who is confident in her capacity and her skill set and takes up, how dare you take up so much space in a room? you know, how dare you have such a big personality and not, you know, literally sing vergüenza, like without shame, like you, how dare you, you know? And so I didn't see those hits coming. I didn't see those hits coming porque yo no sabía que el decisión de sinceramente ser fully myself and how I show up in the world is expensive. There is a cost. And now, como adulta, entendiendo este sistema y la manera en que gente me van a, you know, navigate or whatever word we want to use, now I know how expensive it is. Now I know the cost and I choose to do it anyway. Okay. But I'm also able to anticipate and nurture and take care of myself through the blows because I'm still getting the hits. But now I know the hits are coming and I can take care of myself through it. But there was a, I would say in college, studying I was in the theology and English department. I was a double major, but I would say my personal beginning to awaken. And I'm curious for everyone else, what your kind of like point of awakening was to this patriarchal nonsense. For me, it was definitely in the theology department at an HBCU, okay, at a historically Black university in the theology department, is where I started waking up to, oh, wait a minute. I am being dealt with differently. My confidence, my intelligence, and also my forwardness. I'm very direct. There isn't a passive aggressive bone, vein, tendon. Mira, nada, nada, nada. You're going to get it 10 toes down one way or the other, whatever it is. I'm very clear. And that directness, oh, it's considered masculine. Oh, you're a man eater. You're so aggressive. You're so this, you're so angry, esto lo otro. And I'm like, I'm just not apologizing for my existence. That's what you're actually describing. And I picked up on that in the classroom in college.
To me, it's so interesting que tú mencionas a tu papá, because that was the case that happened with me. So I'm an only child. And so when I was born, both of my parents can't have children. So I was sort of a fluke, a miracle, however you want to call it. And so because there wasn't anybody else in the home, I sort of got all of the parts of their interests and the things that they like. And my dad, same thing. I'm not going to say that he was sort of this perfect person or this perfect like feminist father, but he didn't see in me being a girl an issue. And so I absorbed a lot of his interest. And so I think it's interesting that you mentioned the role that had for you, because I also saw those consequences, Esperanza, growing up. But it was starting with stupid things, like the fact that I knew how to dribble a basketball, or that I would sit down and watch a football game and could actually follow what was happening in the television. And this idea of like how immediately that made me more masculine. And in my particular experience, that tied in together with the fact that I'm not super skinny, and I'm also 5'8", which for my community is considered a tall woman. And so also those things about like, oh, tú eres muy grande. So I was called una Yankee, and I had all sorts of sobrenombre, and all of this idea of like, specifically in the framing of like sexuality and love, you are a woman that I can be friends with, but you are not a woman that I want as a partner, because you are way too intimidating. And eventually when I got to like college and then seminary and now in the PhD, that translated into, you have too much knowledge and I cannot understand it. So I need to relegate it to the side, because you are embodying something that's not what a woman is supposed to be, because it's not soft, it's not fragile, it's not quiet. And I think all three of us, the women in the podcast, share that experience within the academy of what it means to be somebody that is considered to have knowledge and what the cost of gaining knowledge as a woman is. And so I think there's something really interesting there about how the cost of choosing to live in a different way or outside of the ways that we mentioned at the beginning, outside of the sort of policing or the expectations that get put on women, specifically Black women, how that means that you need to accept or sort of reconcile with the fact that that's going to change the trajectory of your life, and it's going to change the way that people are willing or not to engage with you or respect who you are as a person, just because you're daring to step outside of that. And I was thinking music is something that, that's really significant to me. And so I try to always think about how with art we frame things. Y me acuerda mucho la imagen esta de Celia Cruz de la canción de La Negra Tiene Tumbao, right? And this idea of the woman, the confident woman walking down the street con las caderas and moviéndose and sort of like melasi el tumbao, right? And that always sort of gets framed for Latina women as sort of this like very sexual, voluptuous women that's just walking down wanting to be looked at. But when I think about all these things that we're describing, I think it's all not necessarily that. I think it's more of the thing of like, there's a certain thing that one carries as a woman when you decide that you're going to be your full self outside of these boxes, that it does threaten structures and it threatens ideas. And that's dangerous, but it's also powerful and it gives you a sort of different step. And so going back to the first question, I think that's why conversations like these are important, because we continue mientras decimos, ah, sí, celebramos el Día de la Mujer y el 8 de marzo, everybody put stories on their Instagrams and talked about their moms and their sisters and their friends and all of that, there's still certain, structures that are in place and things and ways that patriarchy is still operant, right, in our communities. And I think the next episode we'll talk about this, the way that machismo and the sort of like placing of men in a superior position frames women and defines what they can and cannot be. And if you dare to challenge that, it frames the way that you get to exist in the world, especially if you make decisions that are seen as not what you should be doing, like wanting to not get married or so we can start addressing wanting to not be in the binary of marrying a man. So if you're not heterosexual, or even if you're not cisgender, so like what do we talk about when it's trans women? And so like, how does that come into conversation? Not wanting to have kids or, you know, aesthetically not being femme and presenting in a different way, whether that has to do with your sexuality or your sexual orientation or not, you know? So like all of these ways in which that you get to define yourself in a way, but then society gets to define how you get to move and how the limitations are placed and how that continues to be an issue even today. And so I think there's something there that talks about why it's important for us, especially in a community like the Latina community that's still so heavily patriarchal y machista, why we need to talk about this.
Can I ask a question to the ladies? How do you deal with, and this is related to what y'all are saying, because some of that patriarchal internalized, what has been also called the internalized patriarchal mindset, is not necessarily done by men, but sometimes done by women. How do y'all deal with that? Like, how do y'all deal with that? I don't know. That's what I was thinking about, just because that was the mind. But sorry, Nora, go ahead. I just had that question. Like, how do you deal with that confronting? Like, do you confront? Do you not confront? Do you dance around it? Like,
I think that was a very interesting question, because it was kind of like I was going to kind of comment on what Yolanda has said. I think a lot of the times how these patriarchal thoughts, right, are kind of inflicted by women as well. I think it comes in my personal experience in the policing of your body and in the policing of, you know, I think with how you dress and stuff. Like sometimes I tend to be very tomboyish in how I dress and how like I'm expressing myself. But I know that especially being a Afro-Latina, more specifically Colombian, your body as a woman, since you are a young girl, is police, right? And like, I think that I've gone through my ups and downs with my weight and all of these things. And there's always commentary, right? It doesn't matter if I'm a little thicker, if I'm a little skinnier, like it doesn't matter. There will always be commentary, and especially from the women, right? And I think it goes into the fact that we are supposed to be desirable for other men, and like men can just roll up looking however.
Facts.
However,
can we talk about that part though?
Bro,
can we talk about the imbalance of power when it comes to expectations of desirability?
Yeah, and professionality that also, too. It's
really wild because we are held, especially, you know, Colombian women, we're very vain. You know, Colombia is a very like, you know, what's it called? Narco beauty is a very real thing in Colombia. But like we, you know, we're supposed to be this, that, and da da da. And you know, you look at the partners, the males, and I'm just like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me personally. Now, how I deal with it, I think that for me personally, and one of the things that I do try to attend to and be self-aware about is that I'm very numb to a lot of things, right? So, but it's not necessarily, although I do think it is my coping mechanism and something that I explore deeper with my own therapist, I really do think that that's how I'm able to navigate, because I can't sit here and be hurt every time you gotta say something about how I look, because I can't, you know, most of the time I can't change it immediately, or, you know, sometimes it's not something that I can, you know, that I can change, right, about myself, from my hair to just how I'm presenting. Like, if I just like the way I dress, but then when I'm wearing something more scandalous, it's like, oh, well, you're showing too much. Now it's too much, right? So I think that for me, a lot of it comes with reinforcing who I am and reminding myself of who I am. And I think that going back to the question of womanhood, and I was asking what it is, I think for me, a lot of it is a journey back to myself fully, outside of these expectations and these boxes that people have tried to put me into, is really, really reminding myself that I am a multifaceted being, of course, with my own complicated emotions and everything, but I'm a human, right? As complex as that is, first, I am human, and being a woman is having the audacity to boldly and confidently walk as myself and exist and express at myself fully as I want to. I don't, honestly, a lot of it is just like I hear people and I just have to take it one thing at a time. There will be times where I will confront people and be like, why? Like, you know, the fact that I'm 28 and I'm not married and I don't have kids yet, when I go home, it is a conversation, right? You know, my grandmother will sit and be like, mija, you know, who are you going to live for? You know, type of thing. And I'll be like, grandma, me. I like to live nice, girl. So it's, you know, these, and like, you know, really reassuring myself that that's okay, right? Like my life doesn't have to be by my age of 28 years old. You know, my mother already had a family. My grandmother Ben had a family at this age, but I am walking in my own journey. And that is still a beautiful journey, right? I am still a woman. Nothing in my womanliness, if that's even a word, is kind of knocked because I don't have kids or I don't have a husband.
And I think it's interesting that you I resonate with the idea of the journey, Nora, because I think if I'm thinking about your question, Josue, I think the journey for each person looks different. And the ways that we are willing or not to address something is different. And I think that's also a lesson that we need to learn with this and any other sort of issue that we have socially. Not everybody has to be in the same sort of space to do certain things. So like, I always think, I can't remember who it was, but I always think of this person que en una plática dijo that in a revolution, not everybody has to do the same task, and we actually need people to do different tasks in order for the revolution to be successful. So you like need people que se van a parar y le darle un puño en la cara a los policías, but you also need people that are going to stay at home and use their phones or use their emails or like explotar social media or are going to have food or water, right? And there's different positions. And so I think that's also part of this. And I think the journey for each woman is different as we come into our own. For me, I think that has looked like in terms of dealing with internalized patriarchy with the women around me, I think that has looked like calling out the things that seem small. So maybe not like the bigger actions, but I think part of what perpetuates this is that we continue to use, let's say, phrases or expressions or things that seem small or minuscule that are actually part of what continues to give stability to this patriarchal, you know, heterosexual sexist structure. And so for me, that has looked like cada vez que alguien dice, ah, estás llorando como una nena, y cómo lloran las nenas diferente a los nenes. Like, what does that have to do? Or like, mi abuela le encanta decir una frase, ah, eso no lo hacen las niñas finas. Y yo le dije, pues yo no soy fina, y como quiera soy nena. So like, doing things like that, that it sort of sounds funny, but I think at the root, expressions like that carry very heavy implications when they're used. And so for me, a way in which I've learned to address that with other women who maybe not realize that is to call it out. And not with women, also with men. Like I did it with my father. I've done it with like other men to like, ¿por qué? Like make yourself pause. Why do we use these words? Why do we say, ya está llorando como una nena? Or like, why do we use, especially men tend to use expressions like, ah, es que está en menstruación. What does that mean? What does that mean? Like, what? How does that, you know, things that seem minuscule, but that are part of the foundation that perpetuates this system. And so I think doing that for me is a way in which I have learned to make myself a little bit stronger. Y como dijo Nora, hacer que me resbale, like ponerme mantequilla y que me resbale. So also realizing that, like, if you're, this realization changed my life when I was much younger. It's not that I am intimidated, it's that you're intimidated. So it's a you problem, not a me problem. And sort of learning that and learning how to embody that and be okay with that, I think it's also been part of the journey. And it's also the journey that I've seen other women go through as well, that is sort of in improving the tide of how we are perceiving women in society and how things both politically, socially, even theologically, how everything is sort of changing and moving. And the good example of this that has been in the news for Puerto Rico, this past month, for the first time ever, 4 Protestant denominations in Puerto Rico chose women to their highest office as either bishops or general pastors. And it has never happened before that it's 4 simultaneous denominations. And so like, there's something there, you know, and we can go into like the nuances or things like that, but that's a shift. And that I think is happening with what Nora was saying too, of this audacity to just be and say like, hey, this is the way that I'm living and I'm living for me. And that's okay too. And if in the future that changes, great. And if it doesn't, great too.
A key word that I keep hearing, that I kept hearing from both of you, Nora and Yolanda, human. Like there is a particular way of viewing women that chooses all these other options except human. And that analysis of that happening are the moments where I name things directly. So let me explain a little bit in terms of what I mean. So there is the most obvious way of women being not viewed as human, you know, where we could say more so like the victim, or just seen as more blatantly subhuman, like subservient. Okay, Mo, there's a little more obvious, like, oh yeah, that's terrible. That's so oppressive. Oh my goodness. But then there's also these other modalities of superhero. Superhero ain't nothing but a mule with a crown, honey. You can keep it. The strong Black woman is going to say, you can keep it, okay? And then also we were talking about some of the labels, like como, like with angry and too much. And I also want to throw in crazy. If anybody has any kind of doubt about how present patriarchy and misogyny are, just think about the fact that all any man has to do is whisper the word crazy. Whisper the word in relation to any woman. Reputation gone. Oh, she crazy? Oh, she crazy, dog? And that's all a man has to do is whisper that she's crazy. And there's already mud in the water. There's doubt about her capacity. A woman who is actually in danger, actually experiencing intimate partner violence, can have videotape, can have blood samples, can have all the evidence in the world. And there is still going to be a large percentage of people that either don't believe her or choose to give zero F's. Like, oh, well, I mean, that's her business, okay? Whisper crazy with no evidence versus all the evidence in the world. Okay, that's a thing. So that brings me to another category that is kind of like superhero, but is villain, to be scapegoated. You know, oh, that's crazy bitch, you know, oh my God, okay, all right. And no matter which category you're falling into, okay, whether you're the crown mule or you're the scapegoat, all of these categories is, at the end of the day, women being dehumanized and being used. All of these modalities get used. Scapegoating has the purpose of making people feel better about themselves. You get to remove guilt and remove responsibility. Superhero, same thing. You get to remove responsibility. Oh, I don't have to take care of that because the strong, amazing, fantastical Black woman is going to do all the things. Okay, you have the tool of the subjugated one, where it's just like, well, I got free labor over here. So-and-so is gonna do what I ask her to do. So I don't have to worry about, you know, still being used. And at the end of the day, whenever I see any of those modalities showing up, 9 times out of 10, unless I'm just absolutely exhausted, I have to say something. I have to name that, because the ultimate goal is to be able to exist as human. I don't want to be your queen. I don't want to be your empress. I don't want to be your superstar or cualquier otra palabra tú quieres usar. I understand some of the good intentions mixed in there with some of those hyperboles that we throw out. I will be good when we're in a space that my full humanity is respected and protected. Full stop.
And I think that's part, right, of where we hope to end to where we think about a future, or el un día que siempre hablamos en los episodios, where the sort of the full embracing of yourself and your affirmation of yourself as a human. And I think this has to do both with being Black and with being a woman, is not seen as audacity. It's not seen as like this brave thing. It just is, you know? And I think, con las mujeres en particular, es soñar con un futuro, ¿verdad? Que esa palabra se pueda definir, si le queremos dar una definición, en todas las en diferentes maneras, en quizás todas las maneras que nosotras mismas hemos hablado de nuestras experiencias, sin tener que caer en esas categorías de que tienes que ser mamá o tienes que estar casada o tienes que lograr X, Y o ser una familia o tener una familia, de estas categorías como anticuada y machista, sino que nos podamos mover a una existencia donde ese tumbao que mencioné antes se pueda ver de diferentes maneras, and that is valid as well. And so I think in the most simple way that's what I dream about in the future and what I hope to see, because it's what my 14-year-old self would have wanted when I think about what me at 14 with my first boyfriend and sort of all of these things that I received and comments and expectations that were put onto me. When I think about her, I think about wanting my 13-year-old niece to not have to say the same thing when she's 27 talking with her friends, you know? And so I think more than anything, that's what I think about. It's a future where girls, where women, and in here I'm thinking about all ages, all backgrounds, can sort of live and have the audacity to just live and exist in whatever way they want, and that not be something that needs to be questioned or policed in any way, and that we can actually celebrate, because I think that one thing that I always see during International Women's Day is this emphasis to where we commemorate, but we don't celebrate yet, because there's still a lot of things to be done and still a lot of work to be finished.
For me, I think un día, right? Like we say about the un día, I remember something Bell Hooks wrote, Feminism is for Everybody. And that's a really good essay, like a chapter of it's a really good essay. It's really good. And I think she says, like, embracing feminism, embracing that understanding is necessary for liberation of everyone, is necessary for the liberation of life for everyone. So that's what I think. I think para mí un día sería que sea un futuro que no tenemos que ignorar la, que no tiene, que, o sea, que un día que la patriarca no es la que mande todo, como es que nosotros vemos y nos representamos, but that we all embrace a womanist, you know, approach and understanding of the world, because then life comes from that, and that's what I hope for one day.
Yo creo que para mí el un día sería que también me, lo que está diciendo José me puso también a pensar en Bell Hooks, y ella dijo algo como que el patriarcado no tiene género, o sea, y yo creo que muchas veces nosotros, especialmente de niños, recibimos tantas cosas, tantos mensajes, y yo creo que en esa etapa en que nosotros estamos más libres, ¿sabes? Nosotros estamos viviendo nuestro propio, pues, ser en de una forma tan libre, pero recibimos tantas cosas que nosotros vamos perdiendo, pues, esa esencia de quién somos, y vamos conformando a lo que dice la sociedad, ¿no? Y entonces para mí yo creo que eso sería como el un día en que especialmente los niños puedan crecer sin esas expectativas, sin esos límites, sin esos bordes de quién puedo ser y quién no puedo ser. O sea, yo creo que para mí eso sería algo que tendría presente en esa visión.
Yo creo que para mí un día me gustaría ver la seguridad completa de las niñas y las mujeres. Yo creo que la violencia contra género, especialmente contra las mujeres, es algo que todavía tenemos que trabajar bastante en nuestras comunidades. La protección de las niñas y de las mujeres, y tiene mucho que ver con lo que hemos hablado, ¿no? Las implicaciones y las expectativas que son puestas en las mujeres, pero overall yo creo que, you know, it'd be beautiful if I don't have to think about living alone and how that's unsafe because I'm a woman, or walking after a certain hour because, you know, all of a sudden it's dark and, yo, it can be dangerous, right? Un día yo quiero ver y sentirme completamente segura en poder caminar, ir y progresar a donde sea, sin tener que pensar, oh, soy una mujer, tengo que tener más cuidado.
Yeah. Y yo diría que un día estaremos en una posición como una comunidad que mujer puede, how do I say this? Que un día la situación cuando tiene que ver de like holding men, specifically black men, Afro-Latino people, men, accountable, cuando tiene que ver de su treatment of women, of black women, that a alguien que se considera Afro-Latina or a black woman does not have to pause with fear about whether or not she will even say her story of harm and abuse. That there will be a collective sense of safety that as a black woman, I or we will not be shunned, attacked, and thrown away because we have named harm and abuse done by a black man. Yeah. No fear. In Nina Simone voice. No fear.
Y con ese sueño, yo creo que de no tener miedo es la voz que oigo que resuena con muchas mujeres durante este tiempo y ha resonado a través de la historia. Y yo creo que es el sentimiento colectivo de todo lo que hemos compartido hoy, una vida sin miedo, ¿verdad? Y sin miedo para el colectivo, porque esto nos lleva también al tema del próximo mes, que vamos a estar hablando de esta idea de masculinidad, del machismo y de cómo estas cosas se manifiestan para los hombres latinos. Y nos va a llevar eventualmente a hablar del peligro del binario que nosotros mismos a veces participamos sin considerar personas que no caen en este o que hay un espectro, ¿verdad? Y que no caemos en este binario o que no caen en este binario, que también es algo importante y que también es parte de estas conversaciones. Y con ese sueño de no tener miedo, yo creo que no solo nos lleva al próximo mes, pero nos lleva también al propósito general de este podcast, de todo lo que hemos discutido y lo que esperamos discutir. Así que dejen sus comentarios, cuéntenos cuál es su experiencia, su sueño de no tener miedo, cómo esto se manifiesta en sus hogares, en sus culturas. Para las mujeres que nos escuchan, que es nuestro porcentaje más grande en la audiencia, son casi 75%, déjennos su historia, sus comentarios, sus experiencias. Queremos escuchar, saber si hay algún tema que quisieran tocar o alguna otra cosa que se nos haya quedado que creen que sea importante mencionar. Y como siempre, nos pueden escuchar en Spotify, en Apple Podcasts o en cualquier otra plataforma de podcast. Salimos todos los viernes, tercer viernes, perdón, de cada mes. Este mes y el próximo estamos un poquito tarde, este mes porque hubo un conflicto de schedule, y el próximo mes porque queremos dar espacio a las personas que celebran la Semana Santa para celebrar el Viernes Santo, pero usualmente nos encuentran el tercer viernes del mes en Spotify, Apple Podcasts o cualquier otro. Así que suscríbanse, comenten, denos like, pueden seguirnos en Instagram en @majestadprietapod, y nos vemos en abril. Bye bye.